say we, then probably some people might misunderstand. Mm-hmm. So I should say that if it is less than the Sharia distance, then in that case, the intention of stay remains intact.
Mm-hmm.
The extension or the intention of remaining, staying at a place for 10 days remains intact. It is not affected, and there would be no objection to him.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, whereby we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to travelers based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be exposing who's behind the lawfare tactics being deployed by the Zionist lobby in Canada to silence opponents of genocide. In our first report, Latif Rabbi Chakra looks at the case of Eve Engler, a prominent critic of the Zionist lobby, who was targeted by a coordinated lawfare campaign.
Zionist lawfare hit Canada again the other week. A radical Zionist genocide supporter working with a Zionist lawyer harangued the police to reopen a closed case of harassment. They arrested leading anti-Zionist campaigner Eve Engler. Engler had transparently done nothing wrong, but he was locked up for 5 days. As he has noted, the reason why he has been targeted is because he is a clear-eyed critic of the lobby, who's not afraid to tell the truth. Here is his typically forthright summary of the main Canadian Zionist lobby groups. Together, United Jewish Appeal of Toronto, Montreal, Winnipeg, Windsor, Calgary, Edmonton, Hamilton, London, Ottawa, Vancouver, and Atlantic Canada raise over $300 million annually and have over $1 billion in assets. The lobbying arm of UJA, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, the CIJA, has over 40 staff and a $10 million budget. In addition, B'nai B'rith has a handful of offices across the country. These groups work closely with Stand With Us Canada, CAMERA, Israel on Campus, Honest Reporting Canada, and other, often extreme right-wing Israeli nationalist political organizations. CIJA is perhaps the most prominent Zionist lobby group in Canada. It certainly does a lot of lobbying. The official Canadian lobby register lists the topics, government departments, and lobbyists from CIJA who are involved. It declares 18 separate lobbyists on the register. CIJA, like the rest of the lobby, is inserted in the regime's international network, the Digitel Network. Richard Clark of CIJA was amongst the attendees to its inaugural event in 2018. Clark has now infiltrated government circles, filling the role of Chief of Staff to Ontario's Ministry of Finance. In 2019, several Canadians attended. Adair Craftman of CIJA. Craftman announced in October 2021 that he and his wife were set to become settler colonialists in occupied Palestine. Daniel Corin, representing B'nai B'rith Canada, who now works for Allied Voices for Israel. Qasim Hafiz, Middle East analyst, Christians United for Israel Canada. Hafiz is a British Muslim who has become a collaborator with Zionist groups by condemning radical Islam. The implications of this coordination is that all the key lobby groups are a part of a coordinated network. Gil Hoffman of Honest Reporting let the cat out of the bag on this at an online meeting in 2022.
Today I went to a meeting at the foreign ministry where there were organizations that work in the pro-Israel sphere that they hosted that are their non-governmental organizations. And there were 60 of us there in the room. And the government was explaining what it's doing and how they want to work better with us. It was quite impressive. We've got WhatsApp groups now that are run by the government where we share information, working together.
This coordination is evidently not an anti-Semitic trope about a supposed Jewish conspiracy. It is a factual account of a network strategically organized to pursue certain political aims, those of the genocidal Zionist project.
Joining me in the studio as usual is our resident expert, David Miller, who's widely regarded as the UK's preeminent scholarly critic of Israel. David's a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University, and he's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. And I'm delighted to say that our guest contributor today is the Montreal-based author, political activist, and outspoken anti-Zionist campaigner, Eve Engler himself, who featured in Latifa's report. Welcome to the show. Eve, you spent 5 days in jail on the say-so of a genocide apologist. I wonder whether you could tell us what happened and who was this person who reported you?
Yeah, Dalia Kurtz is her name. She is a prominent Zionist influencer. She used to have a role in the corporate media. she still does a bit, but mostly, or the way I know of her is just that she posts all kinds of racist, pro-violent, anti-Palestinian messages on X. And I, going back maybe a year when I became aware of her a bit more than that, I just responded to her racism by mocking her and a bit, but mostly just sort of political statements. And sometime in the summer, she posted this threatening kind of message about saying, "You are." She quote tweeted me and saying, "You are harassing me. Please stop. This is the only warning I'm giving you." And I just responded in the same kind of way on X of political response with a bit of snarky kind of stuff. Never messaged her. Never contacted her. Don't even follow her on X. She decided not to block me. Instead, she went to the police. The police opened this case against me. They decided that there wasn't enough evidence to move forward. They closed the case. Then this lawyer, Neil Oberman, who's this prominent Zionist lawyer, the leading lawfare activist in Montreal, who's running for the Conservative Party in the upcoming elections,
right.
He sent a letter to the police on behalf of his law firm, and they reopened the case, and then 2 months later they decided to charge me. Yeah. So it was clearly, I mean, Dalit, she didn't even block me on X. It was as simple as, you don't want me to would be able to respond to your racist messages, just block me. She decided not to do that. It was obviously a planned, I assume when she made her declaration on X, she'd already gotten some advice from a lawyer to try to sort of begin the process of opening up a legal front here. And it's part of a broader campaign. Now, I went to jail. It's important to note, I didn't go to jail because I was found guilty of anything that I did. What I went to jail for was to basically, the police wanted to insert conditions that said that I couldn't talk about the case. I couldn't mention Dalia Kurtz's name. Yeah. And I should also note that after I wrote about it, when the police told me to come in to arrest me the next day, I wrote about it later that day. They then the next day charged me with 4 counts of harassing the police.
Wow.
So initially I was harassing the Zionist influencer. Now I'm harassing the police because I wrote about the case against me, and I got and there was thousands of people that emailed calling for me to drop the charges.
Yeah.
So anyways, but I end up basically in jail for 5 days because I refused to accept the conditions that the police and then the Crown prosecutor tries to impose that say I can't talk about Dalia Kurtz and I essentially can't talk about my case. Ultimately, we got before a judge. We won the condition battle, so I'm allowed to do this interview now and mention her name. But that was why I spent 5 days in jail for basically criticizing Zionist influencer.
Absolutely outrageous, even, and a familiar pattern, really, a familiar sort of tactic, I think, that the, you know, the Zionist lobby often use. But David, I mean, this kind of use of lawfare by Zionist genocidaires, I mean, it's kind of getting out of hand, isn't it?
Well, it's totally out of hand. I mean, I'm laughing because it's a hilarious story at one level, but of course, appalling treatment for Israel.
Yeah.
But of course, we see this all over the world. We see it in the UK, we see it in Western
Indeed.
Europe, we see it in North America and in the US as well. But yeah, I mean, we've been saying this, I think, for over a year now, that it is getting out of hand, that they're overstepping, they're overreaching, and there is some evidence that of pushback against that.
Mm.
But the more that there is pushback, the more hysterical they become, and
Indeed.
They start concocting all sorts of nonsense. You know, we've seen through the encampments many examples of young Jews going onto campus and pretending that they're being abused when nobody's actually paying any attention to them. It's an attempt to conjure the genie of anti-Semitism where there is none. And of course, that's the strategy of the Zionists and has been for many decades now. So it's overreaching, but it's not finished yet.
No, right, okay. Well, Eve, I mean, it seems that you were targeted because you're one of the most outspoken critics of Zionism in Canada. I mean, is that your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think that most of my writing criticism of the Zionist lobby in Canada, I would say that's kind of only at the fringes of political life. I mean, the dominant media, even much of the sort of major kind of left media, is not particularly interested in that. I would say the reason that I was targeted, and obviously was targeted by Dalia Kurtz and Neil Oberman, and it's actually because of some sort of social media kind of reporting and activism I do, which is I go to lots of press conferences, and I ask in different public events, and I ask different politicians tough questions. So,
right.
So for instance, there's this mayor of Hampstead, this little municipality of Montreal. That's he's just an over the top fanatic Zionist. And a little over a year ago, I asked him, interviewed him at this Israel event, and I got him to say, of his own volition, that he was fine with Israel killing 100,000 Palestinian children. Because, in his words, good needs to prevail over evil. And it was a very embarrassing clip. It got widely viewed on social media. It got picked up by some corporate media and some international media. So I do a whole bunch of stuff like that. So that, and I did that including to Neil Oberman, the lawyer, the Conservative Party lawyer that is involved in this case.
Yeah.
He's the one behind the injunction against the McGill University encampment. And at the courthouse back in April when this happened, I went and tried to interview him. And he got very angry at me,
and
so I think that it's actually, it's not the, I mean, that certainly contributes to my broader kind of writing
sure.
on the issue, but I think it's specifically this type of social
yeah.
media kind of
no,
reporting
okay.
activism
well,
that has really angered a lot
well,
of the,
no,
the
absolutely.
Zionist establishment.
Well, more power to your elbow on that, Eve. It's really important that these people are. But David, I mean, how does the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, or CIJA, Latifa mentioned in her report that, I mean, how does that fit into the wider infrastructure of the Zionist movement in Canada?
So it's a lobby group. It's kind of like the Canadian equivalent of AIPAC. It was created by the EJA, which, of course, is the main fundraising charity or series of charities for Israel in Canada, just like the UJIA is here or the Jewish Federations are in North America. So it's one of the four pillars of the Zionist movement. So it's like AIPAC, it's like in the UK, it's like BICOM, which does the sort of PR work for Zionism here. So it's a sort of recurring pattern of the way in which they do these things is that they have this kind of lobby group to go into the trenches.
Right, okay. Well, Eve, could you say a bit more with you about the CIJA that we were just talking about with David there, and the broader Zionist movement in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, CIJA is, of course, the main lobby group. It speaks on behalf of the advocacy agent of the federations. But there's also others, you know, B'nai B'rith's important, Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center, Honest Reporting Canada. There's all these Hillels. These are the main kind of activist groups, and there's, you know, a whole series of other Israel on Campus, a whole series of smaller groups. They're the main activist groups, but there's also this whole broader network of of charities, hundreds and hundreds of registered charities that fund Israel and assist Israel, and they do some lobbying. You know, you look at most of the synagogues, they have Israeli flags, and they host Israeli soldiers speaking events, and they, you know, do a whole bunch of things like that. So it is it's a pretty powerful lobby, and it's important to note, like, for instance, with the current Liberal government, the Justin Trudeau, who's just the outgoing prime minister the last 10 years, you know, his main donor, his main fundraiser was Stephen Bronfman. And back in 2013, Stephen Bronfman, in a Globe and Mail article, he said that he brought Trudeau to Israel and that he was supporting Trudeau in part because he was because of his pro-Israel position.
Sure.
And he was claiming that actually Trudeau was more pro-Israel than Stephen Harper at that point. And so he's the leading fundraiser. You know, in Canada, we have restrictions on fundraising different than the U.S. in terms of just wild amounts of money playing a big role in politics. And it's not as out of control in Canada as it is in the U.S. But nonetheless, fundraising still plays a role in shaping.
Yeah.
And that's a really clear link of, you know, again, the lead fundraiser of the prime minister is from this Bronfman family that's famously Zionist going back, you know, a century. They helped get guns to the Haganah during, you know, 1947-48.
Absolutely.
The cleansing.
Well, we're just going to move on now, if I may, Yves. Our next report now about which highlights the opposition to Zionism and how it's growing in Canada, and actually securing some notable victories.
Pushback against the Zionist movement in Canada is building. In November last year, the Canadian branch of the Jewish National Fund lost an appeal to stop Canada's tax department's revocation of its charitable status. Back in July, the Canadian Revenue Service revoked JNF status after a years-long audit revealed the organization used donations to help fund the occupation forces of foreign army, which contravenes Canada's tax code. In the ensuing few months, the JNF Canada has had the option to cede its remaining assets, stated as about $31 million in 2023, or give them to another approved charity. It's likely JNF Canada will try and transfer the resources to another genocidal Zionist charity. In its most recent report, IJV Canada, millions of Canadian tax dollars continue to finance Zionist genocide through charitable donations. There is a clear legal obligation under international and domestic law to shut them down. Another case of pushback launched on February 24, 2025. Activist David Mastriachi published Find IDF Soldiers, a database containing profiles of 85 Canadians that have joined the Israeli military at any point in their lives. Mastriachi writes of the project, "I created a database of many profiles for as many Canadians that have fought in the Israeli military at any point as I could find." The resulting project, Find IDF Soldiers, was published this month and offers the most comprehensive online public database of Canadians that have joined the Israeli military. Some of those profiled have responded with both confident pride and mainly cry bully victimhood. "There has never been a good reason to make a list of Jews. SS-style hit list. Jew hatred has always been around. There is a pretty dark historical precedent for making lists of Jews," one said. "His purpose is to put all 85 of us in danger." Despite the cry-bully tone, there is a sense in which this is true. They should all be put in danger of accountability for their crimes. No doubt any such accountability will not reach 1% of the cruelty and atrocity inflicted on the Palestinians, but at least action is being taken and accountability must follow. Both those serving in the military of the Zionist regime and the Zionist groups which enable them to commit genocide must be shut down in Canada and everywhere else they hide.
Well, David, I mean, that court victory in Canada against the Jewish National Fund, or JNF, it seems quite significant, doesn't it? But it might be just useful, I think, for our viewers, if you just explain what the Jewish National Fund, or the JNF, actually is.
Well, the Jewish National Fund is one more of the four pillars of the Zionist movement, based, of course, all four of the pillars are based, the headquarters of them, in, in Jerusalem, and they have offices around the world in 40 or 50 or sometimes more countries. And in Canada, of course, the JNF has JNF Canada, just like the EJA is the equivalent of the fundraising body in Canada too. They also have the Zionist Federation and an office of the Jewish Agency. So it's a sort of structure which around which all the rest of the Zionist movement coheres. And the JNF, of course, is an organization which is an agency of ethnic cleansing, as Ilan Papi famously put it, and it's there to make sure that they can buy and steal land from the Palestinians and make sure that it never is given back. They have a constitution which says that only Jews are allowed to live on or use the land which they own, and they own a huge proportion of the land of occupied Palestine.
Mm. Okay, well, Eve, what's your view on the court decision against the JNF then? I mean, it seems like a significant victory, doesn't it?
Oh, it's definitely a significant victory. And it wasn't principally a court decision. It was principally the Canada Revenue Agency deciding after many, many years and many, many years of campaigning and all kinds of different reports from anti-Zionists that it was no longer it didn't follow the rules. And Canada Revenue Agency did everything they could to not revoke the charitable status, but the JNF Canada was basically just acting like it was all powerful, and it had meetings with the Prime Minister, and just basically, you know, ignored the revenue agency, and it was, you know, supporting Israeli military. It was also in large part because it was supporting JNF in Israel that the Canada Revenue Agency acted. And no, this is definitely a major victory for the campaign, which is, you know, JNF is an important part, but there's hundreds of these groups in Canada that raise about almost half a billion dollars a year for projects in Israel, many of which actually violate current Canada Revenue Agency rules. Yeah. So yes, definitely a big
victory. Well, it's a good precedent then. It's a good precedent. Maybe it can, you know, be applied to the other organizations that you mentioned, Eve. But David, I mean, in the report there, I mean, the term cry-bully was used by Latifa to describe the response of members of the occupation forces to the database being published, actually, you know, listing who they are. I mean, do you agree with that description of cry bullies? And it's quite a strong...
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic, very apposite description for the Zionists and for these people, you know, claiming that it's terrible that they've been put on this list. And it's like the Jews are being put on a list again. It's like Nazism. Mm. And these are people who've just been engaged in genocide and have no conception. And won't have any conception that they've done anything wrong. And of course, they need to be made to face up to their crimes. And that of course, will be a long process, but they will face up to their crimes. But the other interesting thing about cry-bully as a term is that if you search for the term cry-bully online, you find it's overwhelmingly on the internet, it's used to refer to pro-Palestine protesters, right? But so it's another case of the Zionists Zionists that every accusation
sort of projection
is a confession.
It's projection, yeah. Well, Eve, I mean, what's your take on the Canadian efforts then to hold returning genocide heirs from the occupation forces to account?
Yeah, well, Canada has the War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity Act. That's been on the books since 2000, tied into the Rome Statute, the ICC. And the Canadian government has ignored it. They've refused to pursue Canadians who fought in Gaza. There's been campaigning on it. We, you know, recently just launched an action email campaign, find IDF soldiers, charge IDF soldiers, based upon the website. We know there are hundreds of Canadians that have been fighting in Israeli military in recent years. We don't know the exact number, of course, but it's a large number. But the Canadian officials, you know, there's just a case that came out actually just this last week, this group SARL, which openly brings volunteers, about 150 a year, to go work on Israeli military bases. And we brought a whole dossier, Rabbi David Miviser and Reba Nassal, Palestinian activist, Palestinian-Canadian woman, brought a whole dossier to the police, tried to get the police to launch investigation. They refused. So there was a private prosecution that was done. Right. And a justice of the peace said there was enough evidence that this case should move forward. What happened then is the prosecution, after we won this judgment, the prosecution steps in, takes over the case, and just abandons the case. So then there was just major legal battle to try to basically force the prosecution take the case back. Unfortunately, it failed. But
right.
So even in an instance where you get a legal precedent saying that there's enough evidence to pursue an organization in violation of Canada's Foreign Enlistment Act for bringing Canadians into the Israeli military, the legal system, the judicial system, works to undermine that. So there's
right.
a whole pattern of impunity for Canadians fighting
Absolutely.
The Israeli military and bringing Canadians, inducing Canadians to join the Israeli military.
Very, very interesting to say the least. But David, then, just very briefly, if I may, I mean, the Zionist movement in Canada is quite extensive, isn't it? Which I think makes the efforts of to push back even more laudable. Don't you agree?
Well, that's right. I mean, we've been talking in the show so far about several aspects of the Zionist movement, the central pillars of it, and Eve there mentioned a whole series of different Zionist groups, all of which are active in Canada.
Yeah.
But there's a hinterland to this. And of course, one of the things that you've mentioned there was the hundreds of charities. There are hundreds and hundreds of Zionist charities in Canada working on a daily basis to support the genocide, and including, of course, let's remember, the so-called Chabad Lubavitch cult, which of which there are 150 branches in the UK and more than 100 branches of Chabad in Canada. And nobody seems to know about that. And that's actually another part of the infrastructure
right.
of the Zionist movement.
Right, right. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So a special thank you to our guest, Eve Engler. And thanks also to our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
limelight.
Today, Palestinians in Gaza, despite enduring the worst atrocities in modern history, would rather live among the rubble of their homes than be forced to move out yet again. Any future plan for Gaza without taking Hamas into account is definitely doomed to fail. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, when President Donald Trump said last month he wanted the United States to take over Gaza and resettle its more than 2 million inhabitants in Egypt and Jordan, he effectively put the onus on Arab leaders to come up with a counterproposal. Arab leaders did exactly that at an emergency summit of the Arab League in the Egyptian capital Cairo recently. They endorsed a plan proposed by Egypt to reconstruct the war-ravaged Gaza Strip. Unlike the real estate mogul turned president's absurd plan that was widely condemned, the Arab initiative would allow the Palestinians living in the territory to stay there, something the entire world has consensus on except for the Zionist regime and its main patron, the United States. After Trump put forward his plan for Gaza, which United Nations experts said would amount to ethnic cleansing and a violation of international law, the White House signaled it was open to hearing what an Arab plan for post-war Gaza would sound like. Egypt's three-phase blueprint aims to reconstruct Gaza, which the Zionist regime has leveled to the ground over the past 16 months, over 4 to 5 years, and with an estimated cost of $53 billion. Maintain security and have the Palestinian Authority govern the territory. However, as expected, the Trump administration was quick to reject the Arab initiative. The White House said the proposal failed to take the reality of Gaza into account and that Trump stood by his vision to turn Gaza into a Riviera for tourism in West Asia. That is after driving its residents out of their homes. The Arab vision, which calls for a committee of professional Palestinian technocrats to run Gaza affairs for 6 months before handing power to the internationally recognized Palestinian Authority in the occupied West Bank, was welcomed by Hamas, the Gaza-based resistance movement that the Zionist regime had vowed to eliminate but failed to do so. One could argue that such an outcome would at least be considered a quasi-victory for Israel, which has long described dismantling Hamas, the only independent political actor representing the Palestinian people in Gaza, as its ultimate goal in the genocidal war that killed nearly 49,000 people, most of them children and women, following the events of October 7, 2023. But it's clear that Benjamin Netanyahu wants a bigger piece of the colonial pie, and that is being communicated to the rest of the world by Trump, the best friend Israel has ever had in the White House. Israel sees Hamas as the main obstacle to subjugating the Palestinian people in the occupied territories and forcing them to abandon their long-held dream of establishing an independent Palestinian state with East Al-Quds as its capital. The Palestinians, along with most of the international community, have been demanding Israel withdraw to the 1967 borders. But the Zionist regime has been moving in the opposite direction, pushing illegal settlements deeper into Palestinian lands. Long before the new genocidal war was unleashed on Gaza in October 2023, Israel had been trying to weaken and ultimately dismantle Hamas as a political entity in the territory to pave the way for its colonialist agenda of ethnically cleansing the occupied territories from the river to the sea. With Trump, a former real estate tycoon, back in the White House, Netanyahu has seen a golden opportunity to fast-track that process by taking control of Gaza and turning the narrow strip of land on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea into a luxury settlement for wealthy Zionists and a hub for Western tourists. Zionism, at its core, is based on the forced displacement of indigenous populations through intimidation and cutting of vital infrastructure and basic needs of survival, allowing Israeli settlers to move in and permanently occupy the lands. The Trump-Netanyahu plan for Gaza would effectively kill the prospect of an independent state for Palestinians who want to reunite Gaza with the occupied West Bank as one state with East Al-Quds as its capital. Though the United States has not officially abandoned its policy of supporting a so-called two-state solution, President Trump, both during his first term and now in his second, seems to be moving in lockstep with Israel's far-right by implementing policies that are anathema to an independent Palestinian state. Apart from its potential to become, as Trump's former special envoy and son-in-law Jared Kushner has put it, a waterfront property, Gaza holds another promising wealth that Netanyahu seems to have set his sights on. The enormous gas field found in the eastern Mediterranean, especially off the coast of Gaza. Back in 1999, British Gas estimated that reserves in Gaza Marine alone contain about 1.1 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. That same year, the Palestinian Authority, which governed Gaza at the time, granted the British agency a 25-year contract to exploit the natural gas field. Until now, the Zionist regime has not allowed Palestinians to receive a dime from this natural treasure to which they are entitled. In that context, Zionist regime prime ministers from Ehud Barak to Netanyahu have tried with varying degrees of urgency and through various illegal means to strip Palestinians living in Gaza of their sovereignty over their land and territorial waters. Netanyahu has an incentive to prolong the war on Gaza as long as possible. His genocidal intent, through carpet bombing of Gaza, destruction of its vital civilian infrastructure, and the use of starvation as a weapon of war, point to his desire to displace as many Palestinians from their land as possible. Netanyahu's refusal to enter negotiations with Hamas on the second phase of a fragile ceasefire that his regime was forced to accept in January also reveals the same malicious intent. The second stage of the agreement calls for a permanent end to the war and the full withdrawal of Israeli occupation forces from Gaza. The Zionist regime authorities have insisted that the war will not end until Hamas is fully defeated. Throughout the war, Israeli regime military commanders were often bewildered by how quickly Hamas and other Palestinian groups regrouped and re-emerged in areas of Gaza where they had declared them eliminated and defeated. Israeli regime leaders, not least Netanyahu, know too well that the power of Hamas stems not from its governance over Gaza or even its arms, but from its identity as a robust part of a unified Palestinian society and from its ideology of resistance against Israeli occupation and apartheid. It's noteworthy that most people in Gaza today are the descendants of Palestinian refugees driven to the territory in 1948, and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were forcibly and violently displaced from their homeland to establish a so-called Jewish-majority state in line with the long-cherished agenda of the Zionist movement. Palestinians call May 15, 1948, when the Zionist regime was illegally created, the Nakba, or catastrophe. The Nakba followed a long process of forced expulsion, dispossession, and mass murder. For generations of Palestinians, the Nakba is far from over. Driven by the ideology of Zionism, the Zionist regime continues to oppress, dispossess, and murder Palestinians to this day. Today, Palestinians in Gaza despite enduring the worst atrocities in modern history, would rather live among the rubble of their homes than be forced to move out yet again. The idea that they could be uprooted once more strikes the rawest of nerves for the war-ravaged population in Gaza. And Hamas, being part of the very fabric of Palestinian society, is there to stay with them. Any future plan for Gaza without taking Hamas into account is definitely doomed to fail.
As if the relentless bombing and the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza were not enough, the one sanctuary where Palestinians should have felt safe became a death trap. The protection of hospitals during warfare is paramount and must be respected by all sides at all times. These were the words of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, describing the hospitals in Gaza that should be protected under international law. The Geneva Convention states that medical units shall not be the object of attack. They shall be respected and protected at all times and shall not be used for military purposes. The wounded and sick shall be collected and cared for. Since the beginning of Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, which has claimed the lives of over 50,000 Palestinians and wounded 113,000 others, Israel has repeatedly targeted hospitals, committing mass atrocities against those seeking refuge in medical facilities. Facilities that are protected under international law. These attacks intensified with the onset of ground operations, almost destroying every major medical center in Gaza and leading to the killing, persecution, and kidnapping of the people and the medical personnel. A ceasefire agreement was reached on January 19, 2025, with the expectation that humanitarian aid and supplies would flood Gaza, improving the health system and allowing for the urgent evacuation of patients. However, Israel failed to meet its obligation and by March 1st declared the complete suspension of humanitarian supplies to Gaza, including fuel to operate remaining hospitals. On March 13th, the 53rd day of the ceasefire, a United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry published a report listing certain Israeli violations against Gaza's medical facilities as genocidal acts. How did Israel respond? On March 18th, Israel resumed its large-scale attacks across Gaza, collapsing the ceasefire and killing over 850 Palestinians. The following Sunday, on March 23rd, at least 15 civil and medical crew members went missing in Rafah following their operations there to rescue the Palestinians who were targeted and trapped by the Israeli occupation forces on the ground. Later that day at 9 p.m., Israeli bombed the Mill Surgical Department inside Nasser Medical Complex in central Khan Yunis, killing two Palestinians, including a child, and injuring eight others and rendering the entire department out of service. I'm Ahmed al-Najjar, and today for more on this to discuss the deteriorating health system under Israel's ongoing aggression, I am joined by Dr. Farouz Sidwa, an American trauma and general surgeon based in California and is now volunteering here in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza Strip. Dr. Farouz, thank you so much for joining us, for finding time amid all that you are experiencing these days. Thank you. So, from California to the Gaza Strip during a very critical and challenging time and reality here in Gaza. If you could share with us your journey, what brings you here to the Gaza Strip? And we understand that you've been here in certain key periods all over the course of this genocide. You've been here last year and you came back during the ceasefire and now witnessing the resumption of that genocide. How would you describe the health system situation in Gaza during these three periods?
Yeah, the first time I was here was 1 year ago, March 25th to April 8th, and I was on the eastern side of Khan Yunis at European Hospital, Gaza. And that back then, the hospital basically wasn't functioning. It was because the refugees were inside the hospital, and basically the hospital was a shelter more so than a hospital. We lacked supplies, we lacked almost everything that we needed, but the biggest problem was just there was no way for a hospital to function like this. And the same was happening at Nasser, the same was happening, literally every hospital was the same way because people had nowhere to go, nowhere that they thought was safe. So now that I'm back, Nasser was raided and put out of service by the Israelis in March of last year, so about a year ago. And in, I think, May it reopened, maybe. And the administration decided that they won't allow refugees into the hospital again. So this has allowed the hospital to function properly, but that is the only improvement that I have seen. Otherwise, everything is worse, even before the ceasefire, honestly. Even before the ceasefire was destroyed. When I came back, it was March 6th. That was the first day I worked here. And the first case that I saw was a 24-year-old man, and he was crawling through the ruins of his apartment trying to find the body of his father, who had been killed many months ago. And the building collapsed on him, and it tore his left kidney off of his aorta. So he almost bled to death. It also broke his spine. He may never use one of his legs again. The next case I saw was a young man shot in the left chest in Rafah from the large sniper tower that the Israelis had built there. And he came in, we put a chest tube in him, we operated on him, thankfully he did okay. But all of this just shows you that, the number one, the violence didn't stop. Even though there weren't major explosions happening in Khan Yunis, the explosions that happened months ago were still killing people. When their houses would collapse on them, when children would fall out of the window or off the third floor because the buildings were not stable, this is a major problem. This was a major problem. And then the shootings from the Israelis didn't stop. It was much less, of course, but it didn't stop. And the fact that the territory, Gaza, still has no normal connection to the outside world, even during the ceasefire, no normal connection to the outside world. I think you mentioned the Israelis never allowed the tents in that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the mobile homes that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the proper number of aid trucks in. They prioritized the wrong type of aid, the wrong types of food, things like snacks instead of things like meat for a population that's been malnourished for a year, and especially milk for children, things like this. And then they didn't allow for the evacuation of of wounded people like they said they would, and they tried to restrict, and in fact did restrict, the entrance of foreign medical personnel like myself, coming from the United States, from Europe, from Australia, Jordan, wherever. So overall, the situation actually just continued to get worse. It's true that from January 19th to March 18th, when there was a bit of a ceasefire, some more food got in, and there was some more water availability, some fuel came in, but on March 2nd, I think, the Israelis closed the border again. And since then, there has been no way for people to afford protein to eat. They can only afford the bread and rice that they get from the World Central Kitchen, the World Food Program. There has been no resupply of hospitals. The Nasser still has what we need to do life-saving operations to stop people from bleeding to death. But they don't. We don't have the equipment needed to do reconstructive work. So, for example, a lot of people, including children, have had blast injuries to their arms, and they didn't die. So, alhamdulillah, thankfully, great. That's great. But they have nerve injuries. So their hands are clawing. They're not able to use their hand properly. This is going to be a disabling injury forever.
The question: the lack of supplies to Gaza, the lack of all humanitarian supplies for the people here. Since the start of that genocide, all the needs of the people have been weaponized against them. After the start of the ceasefire, the flow of aid, the improvement for the life here should have been achieved. Yet somehow it got worse. By March the 2nd, the suspension of all humanitarian supplies to Gaza, food, the cutting of power to one of the last desalination plants here in southern Gaza. And of course, how this affects the medical facilities here with the patients inside them. Now, many of the people here, the injured, the wounded, are fortunate to have such expert medical professionals like yourself. But even with that, the lack of supplies is pretty much challenging. How do you manage these challenges?
Yeah, so it's a few things. Number one, for my own work as a surgeon, we don't have all of the supplies that we would normally have, even in a poor country's hospital. We don't have wound vac supplies anymore. The certain types of sutures are harder to find. Right now, at Nasser, we do have the equipment that we need to do life-saving care, but not reconstructive care, so that people can improve their lives also. At other hospitals in Gaza, and especially in the north, the supplies are gone. There's very little that's available. They're making do with the wrong things, but they have no choice. Anesthetics are gone. Antibiotics are not available. Thankfully, here the situation is better, but it will not last forever because, like you said, the border is closed. So the hospital cannot purchase new material. It can't receive new material. And it's not just humanitarian aid that's not being allowed in. Nothing is being allowed into Gaza, not normal commerce. You can't purchase something and have it shipped here because the Israelis simply won't allow it. It doesn't matter if you paid for it. It doesn't matter if it's donated. It's nothing. And but beyond just the surgical supplies in the hospital, the fact that people don't have clean water means they're coming in sick even before they get injured. The fact that they don't have protein to eat means that their body will not heal properly and they will not fight infections properly, no matter what we do. So, and the fact that they have no homes. I mean, in the background here, you can see every building is seriously damaged. They have no homes, no way of protecting themselves from the weather. So all of this takes a toll on the human body, slowly, slowly, slowly. And all of it is resulting in the health of people being much, much lower than it should be.
And when it comes to this resumption of the large-scale attacks across the Gaza Strip since about March 18th, how do you describe the situation in the hospital, the number of the patients, the wounded received here? How do you keep up with treating such large numbers?
Yeah, so actually the Palestinians have learned to do what we call mass casualty very well, just from a lot of experience, unfortunately. Not just in this war, but in the previous ones as well, during the Great March of Return, all these things. So they have an efficient system in place, but again, without supplies, without the needed number of surgeons, without the needed number of operating rooms, without beds. I mean, this whole ward has been destroyed, and the 26 beds that were here, we can't use anymore, because how can you house someone in this place? So it's making it very challenging to keep up with the injured. Most of them, even though we can fix their surgical problem, they're still very sick and they need an intensive care unit, the ICU. But this, we don't have the supplies that are needed or the personnel or the infection control measures. All of this is not available. And so many patients that we save in the operating room die in the ICU later, mostly of infections. Simply because we just don't have the supplies, the resources to care for them. We can't test them properly to see what infection they actually have. Here at Nasser Hospital, we don't have a neurosurgeon. The only neurosurgeons are at European hospitals. So if somebody has bleeding in their abdomen, but they also have a bad brain injury, in the biggest, this is the biggest hospital in Gaza right now because Shifa is mostly non-functioning. So in the biggest hospital in any place, you would have a general trauma surgeon and a neurosurgeon. They could work on the patient at the same time. But right now, we have to stop the bleeding in the abdomen, hope that the brain injury doesn't kill them for 2 days, and then we can send them to European Hospital for brain surgery. But at that point, they don't even need it anymore. They lived, you know. So these are very, very challenging things. And again, with a population that is so sick to start with, you know, the children have not had clean water for almost 2 years. They've not gone to school for almost 2 years. They haven't eaten normally for almost 2 years. They've been displaced over and over and over again. Their levels of stress are through the roof. So it's a very, very challenging thing to take care of.
So speaking of this ward we are sitting right now, the male surgical department inside the Nasser Medical Complex, a ward filled with wounded people who survived the attacks of the Israelis and finally grateful to receive some sort of treatment that hopefully would help them survive. The Israeli missiles followed them where they are seeking treatment. A man and a boy, how do you respond to this?
Well, they're criminal. And in the case of the attack on this ward, actually, I was almost killed here. The emergency medical teams live on the fourth floor of the hospital, and this is the second floor. And I was coming down to change a patient of mine, his dressings. This is a 16-year-old boy named Ibrahim Barhoum. I was on my way to change his dressings, and just 10 minutes before the bombing. And I have to walk past the intensive care unit to come down here. And one of the doctors there said, oh, Feroz, can you help us with this other patient because they're bleeding and we don't know what to do? So I said, oh, yeah, sure. So I went in there, assessed that patient. That took about 10 or 15 minutes. And then I said, look, we need to take this guy to the operating room. So I told the ICU, you tell the operating room so that they can do that. And then I'm going to come change Ibrahim's dressing, and then I'll come back and we'll do the operation. But when I walked out of the ICU, that's when the bomb went off. And I would have, I assume Ibrahim was right here. I would have been standing right here working, just changing his abdomen, talking to his family, because he was going to go home the next day. He was well. So you know, that hit me very personally, obviously. Number one, because my patient was killed. I've never had a patient killed in their hospital bed before. But number two, I've also never been that close to being killed by a military strike. So, but no, it's criminal. It's criminal in two different ways. Number one, hospitals are civilian objects in international law, and medical personnel, meaning me as a doctor or somebody as a nurse, whatever, are also protected people. And it's not just the doctors and nurses; it's actually also the administrators that work in a hospital. Basically, everyone who provides care to the wounded is protected, and that's not just part of the Fourth Geneva Convention from the 1940s, I suppose. It's actually part of the very first Geneva Convention of 1864. So we're talking about, you know, during the time of the American Civil War, things that people said should be illegal in warfare. That's what the U.S. and Israel are doing now. It's really crazy. But number two, so that's one thing. Patients medical personnel in hospitals are protected. But like you mentioned, hospitals are not to be militarized. And the Israelis have been claiming that Ismail Barhoum, simply because he is in Hamas, his presence here is militarization of the hospital. They also said he's planning terrorist attacks here, but that's ridiculous. The hospital is a free area. Everybody could walk around and do whatever they wanted. Nobody saw any such thing. I looked at his picture, actually, because I'd never met him. So I looked at his picture online today. I never saw that man doing anything, walking over. They said he had been here for weeks. It's ridiculous. But so the actual facts of the matter are that he was wounded in a bombing on either the 18th or the 19th, and then he came here to seek treatment because he was probably trying to recover without being in public, but then he couldn't, so he came here to seek treatment. And not only are hospitals and medical professionals protected, but wounded combatants, leaving aside that he's not a combatant, he's just a civilian, but wounded combatants are also protected under international law. When a person is wounded in battle, and then they are being cared for by a medical professional, the doctor, but also the patient are protected. So it's a double crime. It's a crime to attack the hospital at all, but it's also even a crime to kill Ismail Barhoum. Because yes, I understand he's in Hamas, he does the finances or something, but that doesn't mean you can just kill him. And we can see it very easily if we just look at Israel instead. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu had his prostate removed, so it's a surgery, in late December, I think maybe December 27th or something like that. And the next day, I'm sure from his hospital, because he was in the hospital for 4 days, I'm sure from his hospital room, he was running the Israeli war effort. So he militarized a hospital, for sure. Does anyone think that Hamas can go into that hospital and shoot him in the head? No one thinks this. It's crazy. So why is the opposite allowed? Or why is it allowed if the shoe is on the other foot?
Speaking of Benjamin Netanyahu and the militarization of hospitals, I was actually speaking to the director of field hospitals here in Gaza about the targeting of this department. And he said that nothing justifies the targeting of medical facilities. Even if Benjamin Netanyahu himself was being treated inside this hospital, nothing justifies it. Nothing allows anyone to target hospitals.
And just think about it this way. Suppose an Israeli soldier was wounded and a Palestinian brought him here to the hospital and I did surgery on him. Can Hamas bomb this hospital to kill the Israeli soldier in his bed? It's insane. Nobody would accept this.
And Israel just keep using this pretext of